This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of March 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. South by Southwest is canceled over coronavirus concerns.
It's really unfortunate to be canceling South by Southwest. It's a really important event to our city.
Primary elections in Texas answer important questions about who will run in November, but some races still need to be decided in runoff elections.
You know the story of David and Goliath. I will end up being David.
And Austin police hope a new take on a classic game show will help build more trust with young people.
The need for law enforcement to adopt developmentally appropriate, trauma-informed, racially equitable approaches to policing youth.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. No South by Southwest this year. For the past few weeks, a growing number of big companies have been announcing they were pulling out of South by Southwest. They were citing concerns about sending employees to a large international gathering while coronavirus is spreading around the world. So early in the week, Austin public health officials were saying this.
Right now, there is no evidence that closing South by Southwest or other activities is going to make this community safer.
It's Dr. Mark Escott, the interim health authority medical director for the city of Boston. And this was Mayor Steve Adler earlier in the week.
There's no evidence to suggest that canceling South by Southwest makes the community safer.
To be fair, he did say they were reevaluating the situation on a daily basis. Today, Austin Mayor Steve Adler said he declared a local disaster in the city of Austin, and that gave him the ability to order effectively the cancellation of South by Southwest for the year. He held a long news conference, and I want to bring you just a couple of minutes of it to give you the gist of his message. So here's Mayor Steve Adler.
I am proud that we are making decisions that are data-driven and based on the evidence where the sole criteria being applied was the safety and health of our community. I want to thank the folks at South By and other venues for allowing this process to continue as a scientific-based and health-related decision-making process. And I appreciate hearing from the folks in town that have come to me and said, whatever the decision is, just let us know. Let us know what we need to do, and we will participate. It's really unfortunate to be canceling South by Southwest. It's a really important event to our city. It's in a lot of ways tied to who we are in this city. And I really look forward to the next iteration of South by when it comes back again for us. As you've heard, this advisory panel will continue to study and analyze the other unsanctioned events that would be otherwise happening in our city and making determinations as to what is appropriate. As we said earlier this week, this is a evaluation that is ongoing daily with decisions made daily based on the best available information. That's what's happened today. Will continue to happen tomorrow and the next day. And then finally, I would conclude with what Dr. Escott said. There is no emergency in our city today other than the exigency associated with needing to plan and be prepared. And that's what this city is doing now. And I'll conclude with the reminder that the advice to wash your hands for 20 seconds and to fist bump or bow and to not go to school or work if you're feeling sick is not something that's being recommended just so that it gives people something to do. It is, in fact, based on the data and the evidence, the most important thing we can be doing in this community right now to slow the spread of this virus.
By the way, the refund policy from South by Southwest is this. This is directly from their website. South by Southwest does not issue refunds under any circumstances. Any and all payments to South by Southwest are not refundable for any reason, including without limitation, failure to use credentials due to illness, acts of God, travel-related problems, acts of terrorism, loss of employment, and/or duplicate purchases. But this story is not over, because South by Southwest brings hundreds of millions of dollars in economic activity to Austin. Overall, it is just a fraction of 1% of the city's GDP, but it is still significant. An economic analysis by the firm Gray Hill Advisors, paid for by South by Southwest, they paid for the analysis. The analysis found South by just last year alone brought an estimated $356 million and drew more than 400,000 attendees from around the globe. And when you break down the numbers from Gray Hill, you see not all of that $356 million would be lost, but a significant amount will. So operational impact is $157 million. That is the year-round operations of South by Southwest. Because of the scale and complexity of the operation, South by maintains a pretty sizable staff of full-time workers, temporary workers, seasonal workers. But the big loss will be these next two categories. Attendance impact, $182 million. Official attendance impact includes expenditures by South by credentialed participants and single ticket holders at South by events, $182 million. And then consumer impact. That's people who are just guests to South by. They don't have the passes, but maybe they go check something out downtown. They buy a beer at the bar where they're seeing a band play, but they're not official South by attendees. That's about $17 million. So you add up the two, $182 million by official attendees, $17 million from unofficial attendees, and you get a total of almost $200 million. That money goes to conference facilities, music venues, film theaters, retail stores, print shops, transportation companies, and other establishments throughout Central Austin, like restaurants. So Ruben Padron is a manager at Gloria's, downtown on 6th Street. He says South by is a big boost to business.
Starting week one, you know, we start seeing a lot of traffic down the street. Mornings get busier. A lot of people have conferences, all those video games and things. A lot of people, you know, we see people coming in here all the time. So it does more than usual. Yeah, yeah. So this is affecting a couple of days here in our business. Music week is the same thing. You know, all the people come during the night since everybody wants to be in concerts. People get out, they come and eat, have late dinner. So it affects everyone, you know. People do want to see it here, but also there's some concerns about it as well. So.
The coronavirus is so new that most of us, reporters included, not only lack knowledge of the virus and the illness it causes, but also we don't always understand what we don't understand. Meanwhile, we're all getting pummeled with news stories about it every day. Well, Caroline Chen is a reporter who grew up in Hong Kong when SARS hit and then went on to cover the Ebola crisis for Bloomberg News. Now she works for ProPublica on the coronavirus reporting team. And she writes in a new story at ProPublica.org about how, in speaking to dozens of sources every day, epidemiology experts, medical workers, members of the public, a lot of them are not sure what to take away from the headlines they're seeing. Caroline Chen, thanks for talking to KUT.
Thanks for having me.
A huge topic in the discussion of the coronavirus is the death rate. It often comes up as a point of contention on social media when people are debating how concerned to be about the coronavirus. Do we even know what the death rate is?
So the mortality rate, it's being reported right now as if it's like a stone cold fact. And I really want people to know that it's very, very squishy right now. It's an estimate. And scientists around the world are really trying to get a better understanding of what it is. So I want to explain where it's coming from and how it might differ from what you want to know. So when most people think about the death rate, I think they're thinking, if I get infected, how likely is it that I'm going to die? To get to that, you would need to know how many people in the world are infected. And actually, that's pretty much impossible to know at this point in time. And that's because the number that we know in the denominator right now is the number of laboratory confirmed cases. That means the number of people where we actually swabbed them and ran the test and found out whether that was positive or negative. But in fact, COVID-19 in many people presents as a pretty mild illness. It is possible that there are many people who were infected and never went to see the doctor or didn't get a chance to get tested. And as we know in the U.S. right now, we don't have a lot of testing capacity yet. And, you know, this is ramping up right now. So for that reason, the denominator might not be as big as it should be. For that reason, the death rate may be a little bit higher when you hear it in the news right now, because it is the number of people who died divided by the number of laboratory confirmed infections. So I just want listeners to keep that in mind. It is an estimate. And I think the takeaway is that the death rate for COVID-19, the mortality rate is higher than the seasonal flu, but lower than a disease like SARS.
How concerning should that be for the public? A mortality rate higher than the seasonal flu, but lower than SARS?
I think, you know, I've had a lot of people reach out to me and say, like, you know, like, what's the takeaway? Like, should I cancel my plans for this concert? Should I not get on a plane? That's obviously what we all want to know. Like, how do I then behave? And I think it's very, very hard, as much as we want, to just have a blanket set of rules. And it's going to depend on a number of factors. I think the first question you want to know is know yourself, right? What is your personal profile? Like, I am a fairly young person. I am pretty healthy. I am not an elderly person. I am not immunocompromised. That profile looks very different. So that's the first thing. Like, what does your personal health profile look like? Then the question would be, you know, where are you living and what do the cases look like there? So if you lived in the greater Seattle area right now, I would behave very differently than if you lived somewhere in the country where there haven't been any cases reported at all. And then you also listen to your local public health officials. They look at the number of cases and they will give directives, like when they say, all right, we really think that people should stop going to large group events and try to work from home when they can. And they are making those decisions based on the number of cases. And when they think that there is enough transmission going on in your area that they feel like it is hard for them to be able to do what they call contact tracing. And that means to be able to track all the people who have been in touch with someone who is infected, and they can no longer do that anymore, they will tell people to stop gathering. So it's a combination of all these factors that helps you decide what to do.
As someone who's covered contagious diseases and has lived through the SARS crisis in Hong Kong, what is the number one thing the media is getting wrong in trying to help people understand this?
I think the thing that's really hard to convey sometimes is how fast things are changing day to day. And honestly, I hope that listeners can read carefully and try to get that sense of this is a rapidly evolving situation. And at the end of the day, I really don't think that panicking helps anyone. So the best thing to do is stay calm and stay rational and look out for each other. Like, you know, even if we have to stand a little bit further apart from each other, I think the best thing we can do is try to help each other out here and help each other stay calm.
Caroline Chen is a reporter for ProPublica. Her story is called "I Lived Through SARS and Reported on Ebola. These Are Questions We Should Be Asking About Coronavirus." You can find that at ProPublica.org. Caroline, thanks so much for talking to KUT.
Thank you so much for having me.
More than 2 million people voted in the Texas primaries. About 13% turnout in this race where Joe Biden secured a narrow win over second place Bernie Sanders. And of course, there are races determined up and down the ballot. And we were here late in the newsroom on election night watching as reports streamed in of polling stations still processing voters hours after the polls had closed. Maybe you were stuck in one of those lines yourself. It's become a national story at this point. There's a headline in the New York Times that asks, why did it take so long to vote in Texas and California? Some people in Harris County waited 6 hours or more to vote, like at Texas Southern University, a historically black institution in Houston. So what's behind this? Is it voter suppression or mismanagement? Here with insights from the left, Chad Dunn, general counsel for the Texas Democratic Party. Mr. Dunn, welcome to the Texas Standard, sir.
Thank you.
So Texas has closed more polling places than any other state. Democrats have argued that it disproportionately affects minority voters. Why?
What happened here is that a few years back, Democrats had been lobbying the legislature to try to go to what's called vote centers. You know, it used to be the case you had to vote at the polling location by your house. Early voting could be done anywhere in the county. But for some reason, for years and years on Election Day, you still had to go to that polling location at your house. So Democratic members of the legislature wanted to make it easier to where you, on a, Election Day, you could vote anywhere just like you could the other 2 weeks of early voting. Republican members of the House and Senate were opposed to that idea, at least initially. And after some negotiations, a compromise was reached. And that compromise was if we close down a number of local polling locations, then we'll agree to go to these polling locations that you could go anywhere in the county. So a bargain was struck. Now, there's a second component of it. As part of that bargain, the legislature put together a procedure that said that the both local county chairs had to agree to this process. And so what you saw in Harris County is that the Republican county chair there demanded a number of polling location changes and a number of procedures in place for the election that ultimately resulted in the long lines. Until all levels of government focus on this problem and change their attitude, we're going to continue to see these long lines.
Well, you talk about all levels of government. I mean, the elections are mostly run by county officials. And in areas like Houston, those county officials are mostly Democrats, aren't they?
Well, the county officials have to follow these state laws that were passed in many ways to encourage long lines. I mean, you saw the legislature last session got rid of the mobile voting procedure. They've gotten rid of straight ticket voting, which is demonstrated to substantially decrease the length of lines. I think one of the things we're going to see in November, unless there's some changes, is without straight ticket voting, it's going to take every voter in the state substantially longer. Almost 60% of voters use straight ticket voting in most elections, general elections. So, you know, local officials can only do so much. They are governed by state laws. The state laws are written in such a way, often to encourage long lines in certain parts of the town. They try to work around these as best they can. But I'll give you an example of Harris County. The requirement that because the county chairs have to agree on so much of this stuff, the Republican county chair in Harris County demanded that there be an equal number of machines at every polling location for Democrats and then another machine for Republicans. Now, there's two ways you can avoid this problem. The first is if the county chairs agree, which they do in most places, to have a joint primary, then you can set up all the machines in the polling location, put the Democratic ballot on it and the Republican ballot on it, and then whoever shows up gets which ballot they prefer and all the machines are shared equally. But if the party chairs won't agree, then when you show up at the polling location, on one side of the room's Democratic machines only, on the other side of the room is Republican machine only. And then when the county chairs demand that they be an equal number of machines, then you find yourself in a circumstance where it's a predominantly Republican area of town, there'll be half a dozen Democratic machines on the side of the room that nobody uses. On the other hand, when it's on a predominantly Democratic part of town, which was the case at Texas Southern University, you have all these Republican machines sitting there unused while people are standing in line.
But in Harris County,
these things are by choice.
Right, but in Harris County, I mean, those voting machines, some of them are quite old, and I understand that also contributed to some of the delays there.
There's no question that we need to modernize our election equipment. You know, I think the counties are working on that. In my opinion, could they work faster? Absolutely. But, you know, the situation that happened in Harris County was a deliberate choice to not work together under our state laws to run an election that eliminates lines. And we could decide to do that. It's really that simple. We just have to get up and decide as political leadership, we're going to make it as easy to vote and eliminate these lines. And we can do that. It can be done. It's not being done because certain leadership in the state doesn't want it to happen.
Chad Dunn is the general counsel for the Texas Democratic Party. Thanks so much for joining us, Chad.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, let's turn our attention now to the field of a dozen Democratic candidates hoping to challenge the senior United States Senator from Texas, Republican John Cornyn. It did take a while for the results to be completely ironed out, but now that field of a dozen candidates has been narrowed to two. Former Air Force helicopter pilot and Central Texan MJ Hager and North Texas State Senator Royce West. They will face each other in a runoff election in late May. In fact, remember these dates. Primary runoff elections are May 26th, but early voting starts May 18th. As the Texas Standard's Jill Ament reports, it was known early on that the U.S. Senate primary would go to a runoff on the Democratic side, with Hager still being the one to beat.
State Senator Royce West started pulling ahead of labor activist Christina Sinzun Ramirez by a mere percentage point late Wednesday. The two were neck and neck for much of Super Tuesday night after the polls closed.
I'm proud of the race we ran. I ran as a woman, a Latina, a working mom, a progressive that got spent, you know, 4-1, outspent 4-1 by MJ Hager and came in a very close third to the incredible Senator Royce West.
Ramirez says despite the race for second being very close between her and West, her campaign didn't want to call a recount.
As we saw the full tallies come in, and as big as it is in Texas and as expensive as it is to do a recount, this felt like the best way forward to look at the results we had and allow the two candidates to move forward and allow Texas voters to get down to business with the runoff.
Meanwhile, West, the longtime state senator from Dallas, is gearing up for another tough matchup with Hagar. Hagar gained both statewide and national attention in the 2018 midterm election for a surprisingly close margin loss to longtime Central Texas Republican Congressman John Carter. But that loss didn't stop her from being one of the first candidates to launch a campaign to unseat Cornyn. Hagar quickly got the endorsement from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. The move drew criticism from others in the race, including West and Ramirez. Even so, Hagar also out-fundraised her opponents. At his primary night watch party on Tuesday, Senator West told reporters he knows he's got his work cut out for him again.
Yes, we're going to have to raise money. Yes, the Democratic National Campaign Committee has put its thumb on it and given a person the advantage without even interviewing other persons. But, you know the story of David and Goliath. I will end up being David.
Renee Cross is senior director of the Hobby School of Public Affairs at the University of Houston. She agrees going into the runoff, Hagar has the advantage over Senator West.
Between higher recognition, strong support around among Anglo women who are demographic most likely to turn out to vote, and you know, especially in a May election, and the fact that Hagar may be able to access more money for a statewide campaign, I would say that she has the upper hand.
But Cross says not to discount West's ability to catch up, especially in a primary runoff election.
He's got support among the older voters who tend to vote. But West has been around for a very long time, and those in the Dallas-Fort Worth area know him quite well. Plus, he has a lot of ties to the other urban areas in Texas.
Hagar, who gained more than 22% of the vote on primary night, continues to position herself as the strongest candidate in the runoff and beyond. Her campaign said in a statement on Wednesday she was the, quote, clear front runner to take on Cornyn in November. Reporting in Austin, I'm Jill Ament.
A handful of races in Travis County are headed to runoffs. KUT's Andrew Weber has that.
Countywide, voters will choose between incumbent District Attorney Margaret Moore and attorney activist Jose Garza. Garza pulled ahead of the incumbent in early voting totals and maintained that lead as Election Day results came in, but he couldn't pull off the upset. The winner of that runoff race will face Republican Martin Harry on Election Day. Mayor Pro Tem Delia Garza will face Lori Iserlohr in the runoff for county attorney, an office that represents the county in civil suits, prosecutes criminal misdemeanors, and handles family violence cases. Republicans did not field a candidate in that race, so whomever wins the runoff will take over the office vacated by David Escamilla, who's held it since 2003. For Travis County Commissioner, former head of ECHO, Ann Howard, will face off against former state representative Valinda Bolton for the Democratic nomination, with the winner facing Republican Becky Bray in the fall. And in State House District 47, Jennifer Fleck and former Austin City Councilmember Don Zimmerman are in the runoff for the Republican nomination. The winner of that race will face incumbent Democrat Vicki Goodwin. For more coverage of the primary results in Central Texas, head over to KUT.org. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
Juvenile justice researchers have found something that you may already have suspected, that there is a growing distrust of law enforcement among young people all across the United States. But as KUT's Nadia Hamdan reports, some Austin police officers are trying to improve those relationships by using an iconic game in a new way.
It's around 5 o'clock on a Tuesday at the Boys and Girls Club in Northeast Austin.
Hi, everybody. Are we ready?
Half the room is filled with Austin area police officers. The other half is filled with teenagers. And they all have their eyes on a woman named Lisa Thoreau.
At what age can you be charged with a crime in Texas? The youngest.
Thoreau is standing in front of a large screen showing the question. There are four options: 10, 8, 12, or any age. As the kids deliberate, a timer slowly ticks down.
Okay, but like 12, though, like, because, you know, at 8, you don't know. You're not really going to do
anything. Time's up.
So what is your name?
So what's the answer, y'all? Time's up.
B.
It turns out the answer was A, 10 years old. The team just lost 100 points.
I said A, you didn't hear me?
This is a Jeopardy game about the do's and don'ts of the juvenile justice system. And Thoreau is here as part of a pilot program to teach the officers. She's the CEO of the Boston-based organization Strategies for Youth, which tries to help law enforcement foster better interactions with young people.
And we also do that with young people by bringing them this juvenile justice Jeopardy game so that interactions proceed more safely, more calmly, and everybody is interacting in a way that ensures better outcomes.
Thoreau's research shows a large majority of the kids who've played this game across the country say they didn't know how to answer 50 to 75% of the questions.
Another 10% said 100% of the information was new to them.
She says this suggests the game is working. It's that spoonful of sugar, a way to help young people digest some of life's harsh realities. And the reason Thoreau and the game are in Austin is because of APD officer Jeremy Bohannon. As a member of Austin's Police Activities League, Bohannon spends a lot of his time trying to create positive encounters between youth and police. And he's wanted to get the game here since he first learned about it over 4 years ago.
You know, I've always known that there was a lot that kids don't know. And usually the misunderstanding leads to fear. And then that fear can lead to them doing things that, and they don't know any consequences. And so being able to provide people the consequences, the opportunities that they could be missing because of something that they did, is very important.
But more than that, he says this is an opportunity to connect, a chance to shorten that social distance.
So we want to give as much information so that they understand us, and then they understand that we actually do care about them.
Thoreau says this is one of the main objectives of the Jeopardy game, developing better relationships. Her research shows there's been an increase in distrust and fear of law enforcement stemming back to 2014. This is when 18-year-old Michael Brown and 12-year-old Tamir Rice, both black and unarmed, were fatally shot by white police officers.
And those two incidents, it demonstrates the need for law enforcement to adopt developmentally appropriate, trauma-informed, racially equitable approaches to policing youth.
Racially equitable. It's an important piece here because the majority of the 17 and 18-year-olds in the room are black, a group that is arrested and jailed at a much higher rate than their white counterparts. The city of Austin released a study in January that found black people made up 15% of drivers stopped by police, despite making up only around 8% of the city's population. This may help explain some of the moments when the tone of the Jeopardy game changed. At one point, Thoreau starts talking to the kids about how the media shows youth violence at a much higher rate than it actually happens.
And so you have to understand that adults like me and some of the other ones here, when they see young people coming, see danger, okay? And this is worse for kids of color. That they perceive youth of color as much more dangerous and much more likely to be arrested for criminal involvement than they actually are. No. I'm saying the media has depicted young people generally as being dangerous, but youth of color as being especially dangerous. Okay?
No laughter this time around. And although it's a little hard to hear, many of the kids are pushing back, asking why. Is that the way she sees them? One student asks. Thoreau is white. And Sherwin Patton says this may be why the message was lost.
We're receiving information from people who can't fully understand what it's like to be a black man or a black woman in America.
Patton is the director of Life Anew Restorative Justice, an Austin-based organization that works to keep young people out of the criminal justice system. He says law enforcement needs to commit to two things if they want programs like this to be more effective. One is inviting people from the same communities they're trying to help to be a part of these conversations, people who know what it's like to be singled out.
Because they know exactly how it feels when someone makes a call that there's suspicious activity going on, but you're doing the same thing as everyone else that's in that area. I mean, there is no way to describe how that feels. And then it's no way to describe how it feels when you're having an interaction with law enforcement and you know that you haven't done anything wrong.
But Patton says the best way to connect with these kids, take some time to listen.
And I think that that's probably what most of Black and Brown America, people of color, are saying. I want you to listen to me, understand me, and then feel me in a deeper place than you've ever felt before. Because if you do, then maybe you'll come alongside us in order for us to make some real, meaningful, sustainable change.
It's the end of the game, and Thoreau looks to the kids for feedback.
Do you think this is a game that your peers would find useful?
Almost all of them said yes. Here's one young man's response.
I think everybody should know stuff like this. I think.
Why?
Because.
It's useful in life?
I mean, yeah. The police are always going to be around you, whether you like it or not. So it's best to know what the consequences are for your actions when you get them. That way you walk into every situation prepared. You want to know how cautious to be all the time.
APD Officer Jeremy Bohannon says the plan is to train more officers on how to play this game in Austin and surrounding cities. His goal? To educate as many young people as possible and hopefully build more trust. Nadia Hamdan, KUT News.
That is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of March 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.